My name is Nadine Addington, and my husband is James Addington. And some of your faces look familiar from the other two times, and some of them don't, but they're all becoming a blur right now. We need name tags, but then that wouldn't make any difference either, would it, because they come and go. Anyway, I just want to briefly review where we have come from and where we are tonight outside of being in Holden. We are in our third session on the topic of racism, a contemporary social spirit force. And in our first session, when we talked in our presentation and our exercise, we disclosed how racism is a complex issue for our society because of its subtleties, but yet its painful action, and those who are participating in that and those who receive that action. We found out that we have a situation of institutionalized racism. And when we went through the dynamics of the triangle, which I won't go through in all the parts, we discovered that prejudice and discrimination and power are all intertwined with the action of racism. And then our next session, we dealt with how that shows up in our environment. Now, that's not the only place that it shows up. And we saw that in our workshop, that the environment issue is very much related to social justice issues. And in our workshop, we also found that we could not deal with either one of those separately because of the interrelationship of all of that. So tonight, we're going to even step back further and dig into the roots of the causes of racism and how it shows up once again in our society, but look at it from a historical perspective. Our spin will be a contextualization of that. Our exercise will reveal the historical roots of that and talk about history. And I'm using the word history. Maybe we'll come up with their story, her story, our story, and figure out how it is that we begin to look in a new direction after we discover the roots of it. And then our fourth session is to deal with the myth behind that and then begin to think more futurically on building those planks across the abyss of what it would be like if we did not have this situation, or what it would be like to change this situation. So we will come up with a new myth. And here I mean myth by story, not something mythological or something abstract. And then in our last session, talk about the role of the church, the gospel, and repentance as we try to deal with the issue of racism in our society. So with that brief introduction and review, I will not bore you much longer and let James Addington bring the context.
Let me spend just a few minutes, yes.
If we're going to be using the board, can I suggest moving it back some for the people?
Okay, why don't we do that?
Is that better?
And we're going to be asking you to move around a little bit shortly also.
Yes.
So
don't not much.
Don't get too settled in your chair. How many of you in the room have African-American heritage? African heritage. How many of you in the room? Let's see a show of hands.
Me.
Well, you decide what I mean. Well, you may be interested to know, all right, you may be interested to know that a few years ago, the sociology department at Ohio State University did a study using established anthropological models and careful research of the genealogical records of a sample of the white population. And based on that research and their extrapolations, they came to the conclusion that probably 1 in 5 white Americans have African American heritage. Now, I guess there's probably about 60 of us in the room. If that held true for us, 12 of us in the room that did not claim African heritage have African heritage. Geneticists in recent months who have been studying the relationship of genetic development and linguistic development have come to the conclusion that African Americans today in our country draw about 30% of their gene pool from Europe. That does not mean that any single African American is one-third European. That'd be kind of hard to discern or to figure out. But that on the average, African Americans draw about 30% of their gene pool from Europe. And of course, there's another side to the coin, which we talked about earlier. In addition to that, probably or somewhere around 29% of African Americans have Native American heritage. How many of you in the room have Native American heritage? Not very many of you look like you have Native American heritage. Genetics is a very interesting phenomenon. And of course, in our history, we've distinguished and classified people according to skin pigmentation. And that really, we found out in recent years, is not an accurate way of deciding who came from where. Racial identity is a very intriguing subject. Very intriguing subject. In the United States, and I want to focus on the United States, this would also be true in Canada, probably to a lesser degree. But in the United States, and as a matter of fact, in probably much of the Americas, the fundamental racial dynamic has been between those of European ancestry and those of African ancestry. That has been the basic racial tension, the basic racial dynamic. That is not to say, of course, that's all that's been going on. As those of us who've been participating in the quincentennial sessions have, you know, begun to think about. Because clearly, Native peoples have also been part of that formula, and also have Asian peoples. And then, of course, the clash of cultures from Europe and indigenous America with Africa thrown in really has even created a new people that some have called La Raza. A Mexican philosopher, Jose Vasconcelos, suggested that in America we have seen the emergence of a new racial stock that he called La Raza Cosmica, the cosmic race, and others called mestizos. And it's very interesting to talk about the various ways that we've classified people according to their mixtures. I want to back up and do a quick little spin for you through colonialism, slavery, and maybe what you might want to call the African-American Holocaust. Very interesting, isn't it, that in our academic institutions, it's not at all unusual, for example, in our seminaries, for professors to draw illustrative material from the European Holocaust. As well they might, but not many draw illustrative material from the American Holocaust, as well they should. When you look at simply what has happened in the history of this continent in relation to Europe in the last 500 years. Let's take a look. First, the beginnings of European participation in the slave trade. As you know, slavery is an age-old institution in our world. One of the intriguing uniquenesses, however, that European participation brought to the slave trade was a common denominator that finally boiled down to skin color. Finally, the slave trade under the auspices of Europe had to do with what they called race and racial identity. The slave trade probably, you could say, began. European participation in the slave trade began when Henry the Navigator, do you remember studying about him in school? I do. Prince Henry the Navigator, one of the Portuguese heroes of the Age of Conquest. Well, Prince Henry the Navigator from Portugal and his sailors landed somewhere on the west coast of Africa, raided a village, killed most of its inhabitants, captured a bunch more, and took them back to Portugal as slaves. And that was the beginning of the European slave trade. And what that meant was that the first wave or the first phase of the slave trade was from Africa to the Iberian Peninsula, primarily Portugal. And there came a time in Portugal, by the way, this happened in along about 1444. There came a time in the cities of Portugal when many of the cities and towns became predominantly African. And then over the generations and the centuries, the African mixture has blended into the population. The Portuguese have been known, of course, for their willingness to mix the stuff of their being with whoever they happen to be in contact with through conquest. And so the African mixture simply blended into the population. But as a consequence of that initial participation, Africans also wound up in Europe, and even in the British Isles and in other parts of the Mediterranean. Now, you may know that some scholars even think that Beethoven had African heritage because of the dramatic description of his appearance. He was a very dark man, and his features, as he's described, very African. And possibly even his teacher, wasn't his name Joseph Haydn? Some scholars believe there's some solid circumstantial evidence to suggest both those men had African heritage. Of course, you never hear such things like that these days, do you? Not even in these informed times that we live in. The second phase, then, of the slave trade came on the heels of the opening up of the New World by Columbus. The Spaniards, first, as you know, when they came upon the shores of the New World, the conquistadores were interested in gold and glory. But after them came the planters. And they discovered very quickly that the fertile islands of the Caribbean were great for growing sugarcane. First, they tried to make slaves of the Indians. Some of the Spanish priests that accompanied the conquistadores and the planters became advocates of the Indians. And one of them, Bartolomé de las Casas, was an especially articulate advocate of the Indians and pressed the crown, the Spanish crown. He was even imprisoned once for his vociferous support of the Indians. But he suggested as an alternative that perhaps Africans might work the sugar plantations better than Native Americans. He lived to regret that suggestion, by the way. But that opened the door for the importation of African slaves into the New World and the second phase of the slave trade, which, as you know, was primarily this section of Africa. So that the first slaves, then, on the infamous Middle Passage, went to the Caribbean to participate in the growing of sugar cane. Isn't it interesting that sugar that we all enjoy so much these days was so important and played such a critical role in the beginning of one of the most bloody and tragic chapters in human history. You may remember that the Pope drew a line when Spain and Portugal were battling over, you know, who was going to get to settle what lands. The Pope drew a line and said, on this side the Portuguese can have at it, and on this side the Spanish can have at it. The Spanish side of the line of demarcation did not include Africa, so they could not participate directly in the slave trade. And so they created an agreement where, in effect, they gave a contract to competing nations to supply them with slaves. And Portugal stepped in first, and then Holland stepped in, and France, and then Great Britain, all battling for the Spanish contract, the Asiento, I believe it was called. And that really began the infamous stream of Africans to the New World. Now, when did the first Africans reach the shore of the New World? Well, that's a little hard to say. Some scholars think there's fairly strong circumstantial evidence to suggest that maybe over 1,000 years ago, African mariners visited the Caribbean coast or the Atlantic coast of Central America. Interesting that, for example, the Olmec sculptures in much of present-day Mexico and southern Mexico, very African features of the sculptures, the faces. Also, it's very interesting that many of the native peoples of the Amazon basin, I mean, people that are deep in the Amazon basin. Many of them have characteristics that are very similar to some of the Bantu peoples in Africa. And so there's been, you know, speculation that maybe there was contact much earlier than we know of. But in terms of colonial times and post-colonial times, in the early 1500s, probably the first Africans landed on these shores. And one of the first, if not the first, was a man named Esteban, or Estebanico, who accompanied Cabeza de Vaca, a Spanish conquistador, and became separated from him and wound up exploring much of Mexico and the southwestern part of the United States before he made his way back to the coast. Another African person, man, accompanied De Soto and ended up staying in Alabama and living with the tribe of Native Americans and, you know, just sort of disappeared from view. But in terms of the slave trade, the islands of the Caribbean and sugarcane, and then Mexico and Central America and Northern South America and Brazil, all became ports for the importation of slaves to assist with the planting of crops and the clearing of forests and so on. Interestingly enough, in terms of North America, the first Africans to appear in North America came at least 1 year before the Mayflower, and they were not slaves. They, in fact, were indentured servants. Landed on a ship, they were on a ship that probably was a pirate ship. And they were put ashore and sold and became indentured servants. And from about 1620 until about 1660, slavery as such was not an institution that was really taken part in by planters and colonists in North America, but indentured servanthood was. And you may remember that thousands of Europeans, primarily British and Irish, were indentured servants. Some of them were even kidnapped off the streets. Many of them were deeply in debt and sold themselves to pay off the debt, and then would work off their bondage in the New World. And then when they worked it off, they became free. And the laws in many colonies said that they had to be paid a certain amount when they were set free. And many of those indentured servants were Africans. For a period of 40 years, really interesting, the concept of whiteness apparently was not even an aligned concept. People did not even think of being white. Black and white indentured servants labored together in the fields, lived together in huts, and mixed rather freely. Now, I don't know how many generations you can trace your tree back into this continent. How many of you have been here for four generations, your family? How about five? Well, anybody who's been around here for four, five, six generations, well, you just imagine how many family trees that is that waters you. You go back just four generations, and that's 16 different bloodlines. What do you think the likelihood is that genetic material from Africa floats around in your veins? Or genetic material from indigenous America? Particularly in the first 40 years, 1620 to 1660 or so, there were sections of Maryland and Virginia where large mixed populations lived. And there were even towns in Virginia that were African towns. Now the colonists began to get a little upset, a little worried. And around 1660 or so, they began to enact laws that changed the status of black indentured servants. And in effect was the institution of slavery and was the creation of a new mythology based on race and white skin. Yes?
Why did they get worried? Was it because of some economic reason? I mean, prior to the...
There were a number of things going on, and some of them were directly economic. People were beginning to press that we needed more people to clear the land and work the fields. The Native Americans were just trouble. They were just in the way, and they were not good servants. And not only that, but if you had a servant that you had to set free after a few years, who would go off then and open up his or her own land, well, so economic reasons were one of the pressures that began to press people. and the slave trade was beginning to go on. The stream had become a river, and from about 1660, when laws were put on the books in some of the colonies that changed the status of Africans, literally made them lifelong slaves, so that it became impossible for any African to work his or her freedom. And at that point, practically speaking, slavery became an institution that the colonies in North America were involved in. And that was like a trigger. The high point of the slave trade then was probably the middle of the 18th century. Throughout the 1700s, the stream from Africa became a torrent. And the infamous Middle Passage was named. Now, it's interesting when you look at the history of those times and read the research of people that's been done. And even at the high point of slavery, there was still a fair amount of mixing between particularly the poorer settlers from Europe and slaves from Africa. Many of them would run off. And what was happening to the Native American populations along the coast here was also very interesting. The American settlers, of course, from Europe were clear that they wanted to push the Native Americans off the land they wanted to use. And the leadership of the colonies really gave tacit and explicit approval to that. Ben Franklin was very clear about it. Far as he was concerned, Native Americans were all worthless rumsuilers who were not productive because they didn't work the land. So over a period of 100, 150 years, tribes were either decimated by disease, totally wiped out, or pushed further west. But many of them disappeared from view, but continued to live in the bloodstream of what had been the slaves. Yes?
What was happening in Africa over this period? Now it's 200 years.
Yes, right.
And
You probably remember that there were great empires along the coast of Africa way back even before slavery began. And as a matter of fact, in the early 1500s, one of the kings from a little kingdom right here was made a bishop by the Pope. And several of his young men were sent to study in Rome to be priests. And he petitioned the Pope to intercede on behalf of the African republics to stop the slave trade that was beginning to bloom and blossom. The European technology that was available, gunpowder, meant that the people in the very complex societies along the coast militarily could not compete.
So there was no war to stop?
There was continued resistance. Continued resistance. But of course there was a little bit of complicity.
Africans didn't have gunpowder?
No, that's right. They did not have gunpowder.
They didn't have guns.
And some of the republics, some of the societies along the coast sold slaves to the traders. Complicity probably by Africans is not as dramatic as often is painted by historians, but nonetheless there was complicity by some Africans in the slave trade.
Selling their own people.
Yeah, that's right. Even among
from the empires.
Yes.
Pompeii, Mali,
and Ghana. Quickly, let me throw in a couple other things where I want to do this, polish this spin off in a few minutes so we get to some work. As you get toward the American Revolution, very interesting things begin to happen. There are a number of free Africans living in the northern part, particularly of the colonies. And you probably remember from your history books that the first person to be killed in the Boston Massacre was Crispus Attucks, who was an African. He was an escaped slave who had gotten quite a reputation along the docks in Boston and was a man who apparently had a lot of natural leadership ability. And he organized and led the colonists against the British in the Boston Massacre and was the first American to fall to the British bullets in the Boston Massacre. And then what's even more intriguing is that during the American Revolution, thousands of the people who fought against the British were Africans, slaves and ex-slaves. And during the height of the American Revolution, several thousand soldiers from Haiti, African soldiers, came to North America and fought on the side of the revolutionaries against the British. And this is at the time when Haiti itself was struggling for its independence under the leadership of Toussaint Louverture. And you may remember that in 1803, Haiti kicked out the French, defeated the forces of Napoleon, and became free. And that was one of the events that sent a shockwave through North America, because there was continued resistance among slave populations. We know of Nat Turner. There were many other uprisings. And when the Africans in Haiti threw the Europeans out, it sent a shockwave through European Americans in the new Republic of the United States, and resulted in a kind of a tightening down of the grasp of slavery. Along about 1849, let's see if I've got my date written down here. No, I can't find my dates, but either 1849 or 1859, somewhere along in there, was the last slave ship from Africa which docked in American ports. The striking thing, it seems to me, about all that's gone on over the last 500 years, and if you've not read the accounts of the Middle Passage and the vivid descriptions of what it was like, you need to do so. And we particularly need to do so. We need to be aware of what was going on in those days, because we are living on the fruits of those days, of the expended lives. As one historian put it, African slaves were the venture capital, the startup capital of the American society and economy. Now you think about that for a little bit, and that's the way it was. That African lives were the startup capital that gave a jump start to the American economy in the 1600s, 1700s, and 1800s. And even those of us whose families, we can say with some clarity, did not participate in slavery, nonetheless, we live off of the accumulated gains from that initial venture capital. Some books I want to recommend to you, I'll leave up here on the table, we found helpful. Before the Mayflower is a classic. If you've not read that, it's written by Lerone Bennett. It's had several printings, the most recent being, oh, just 3 or 4 years ago, originally published back in the early 60s. One of the most exhaustive and careful studies of the slave trade and of African presence in North America, and also the relationship between native cultures and African imports. Then a book called Who is Black? We'll work more on this tomorrow night. But it's an attempt to describe how we in the United States have described who is black. In the 1800s, there was a rule of thumb established called the one-drop rule, which said that if you had any traceable African ancestor, you were black. How many of us in the room would be black under that rule? The one-drop rule held sway clear up into this century. Then another one we found very helpful, just recently published, Two Nations by Andrew Hacker. And then finally one that I picked up just the other day, very intriguing, particularly in describing the role of women in slavery, as well as the role of African-American women in the feminist movement, by Angela Davis, Women, Race, and Class. I'll leave these on the table, and so long as you don't borrow them, just write down the names. Why? We've not finished with them yet. Well, this has been really just scratching the surface in order to kind of seed our imagination and give you some images, and clearly we need to spend a lot of time talking and do a lot more research here, but maybe this will be enough to get us going.
Mm-hmm. One small correction, we won't be around tomorrow night, we'll be around Friday night.
All right.
Yes. Go ahead. Question?
Is there any estimate of the lives lost? Is there any way to even determine it? Has anybody attempted to come up
with this? Well, some of you may even know other numbers. Conservative estimates are that 20 million people were taken from Africa. Some historians say that as many as 15 million were sent to Brazil. One Brazilian researcher thinks it's probably closer to 5 million. At least a million stayed in the Caribbean, but the Caribbean was a staging ground for Central, South America, and North America. How many came to North America is not clear, but it's interesting that in the early 1800s, there were states and colonies in the New Republic that had more black people than white people living in South Carolina, for example, in Mississippi. So probably at least 20 million people were taken from Africa over a period of 500 years, or less than 500 years, 300 years.
And all the accounts that talk about the number who died on the way, what would it be, like 4 million? 5 million?
Nobody can count that. Nobody can count. And if we had more time, we could sort of graphically portray for you what the Middle Passage was like on one of those ships.
Question.
Do I get this straight now? Slaves were brought over, so empty ships weren't going back. They brought back sugar cane.
Very often they brought back other things. Some ships were outfitted to serve only as sailors. And it's interesting, but John Newton, the author of Amazing Grace journals, that you could tell when you were approaching a slave ship before it was even visible, because you could smell it.
Why didn't they enslave the Native Americans, though, since they were already there, they wouldn't have to ship them over?
Well, there were many reasons, and I guess it depends on who you talk to. They needed more people than the Native Americans could provide. The Native Americans were quickly decimated by disease in some areas, and particularly in the Spanish areas, some of the priests became fervent advocates of the Native Americans.
Why the Native Americans instead of the Africans? What is the difference?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, we're taking some of your time, but interestingly enough, when you look at Spanish and Portuguese slavery was here, French slavery in the Caribbean, British Protestant Puritan slavery in the north, and the records suggest that the cruelest and most difficult was, guess who? British Protestant Puritan. The Spanish and the French could be cruel, but as often as not, were not. In Jamaica, for example, when the British took the island from the Spanish set their slaves free and gave them provisions. And they went up in the mountains and became known as the Maroons. And they fought the British in guerrilla-style warfare for decades.
Okay. Got a little bit of an exercise to do in our brief time together. As you have discovered, this is more about historical recollection and information. We're going to do some more of that, and we're going to do it over the period of 500 years, beginning with 1492 to the present day. And our focus is going to be on North America, the Americas, and we'll be talking about events that have taken place that both affected what was going on in America, and those events could be from outside of America and different places around the world, that affected the Americas. So what I'm going to do first is to have us all think together about a few events, and then you're going to think together in chunks of 100 years in five groups in the next 20 minutes about what kind of events that have taken place over the last 500 years. And that's not going to be too difficult. And we want to focus on the perspective of persons of color. From the events that you give us, I want you to talk about the events from the perspective of persons of color. So when we start this, first of all, we're going to have you give Jane some events beginning 1492 to 1992 from the perspective of persons of color that happened in America, the Americas, and events that affected the Americas from around the world. Does that make clear?
Okay. From the perspective of people of color. Not from the European perspective.
That's correct. Okay. So, first of all, what are some events that you remember in any of these, blocks?
Civil War.
Okay. Civil War.
When was that?
In 1865.
Others?
1992, Rodney King.
Okay.
What did she say?
She said 1992, Rodney King, Los Angeles.
Who knows when the first Native American became the head of state of a post-colonial nation in the Americas?
Say that again.
First Native American became head of state in a post-colonial nation in the Americas.
The Juarez?
Yes, Benito Juarez. That's right. You remember the year?
In the 60s.
Yes, it was. Right after our Civil War began.
Others?
1952, Brown versus Board of Education. I think it was 52.
King assassination.
King assassination.
Got it.
I think they got it. Okay, I need five groups. I'm going to start with 1492 to 1592. Gosh, this group is so big I can't hardly count off. Let's see. Just as long as we make sure everybody gets to participate. Right along here. What's your first question? Jane? Okay. Jane to back table. You're going to be the 1492 century. 100 years. From you. Ah, over to Bert. Well, I make it a message. Okay. You'll be the next century. 15. 16. Right in here. I got some outside. You can all come in. Which century are we in now? 16? 17. Okay. 17? Are you? Okay. 17. Oh, it gets smaller, doesn't it?
That's all right, they can work faster.
The lady in the road seller top. Up to you. Okay, you're gonna be the next century. 17. And then get smaller. You'll stop with the man in the yellow shirt. And you'll be 18. Does that make it? 19. All right. Oh, yes, she says. Now, instructions. Briefly, everybody's going to do the same thing. What you're going to do is focus on your century. 14, 19. How little do you remember?
How little I know. A little
red. Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, bothers me, I haven't been able to look at the whole thing, but just in our square was how still we talk in terms, the things that we choose are the two cultures going like this rather than knowing who is the great, who are the great leaders or the great accomplishments of the culture of the people of colors. And we still look at it in terms of very centric, Eurocentric, bicultural centric interactions with the people of color. And maybe we can say, yeah, and it was awful for the other folks involved, but I just don't know. I don't know when the Iroquois Nation designed the wonderful system of government which we imitate. I don't know those type of I don't know when it was that Chief Seattle wrote his wonderful thing about warnings about the environment and such, and or there must be all sorts of stuff. I just don't know. Mm-hmm.
Others, you've got your attention as you worked on this.
How little we've been taught in school of things like that from their viewpoint. I mean, we just learned what the Europeans have done.
More or less, the history of a people has been eliminated through education.
The history of a people, did you say?
I said a people, but okay. You can say many people. But I mean, the same thing in Australia.
Okay. What happened to you as a group when you were working on some of this? and we find a group.
We got warmed up more and more as we think more and more, and it was really hard to pick only five. And I think we would have thought of many more things if we'd had more time. We just started getting warmed up. Of course, we were the...
You were denying. Two things. One is, this is going to stay up. We're going to find a spot in this room. I think we've claimed this room somewhere, except that we might have to go to the next one. And you can add, as you think about it, events to this journey. And secondly, we're going to stay around, so if you want to continue to have conversations.
At least till best.
At least till best. Okay. You're on.
Okay. Well, to pull this to a close, at least for this evening's session, by doing a couple of things. First, let me ask you a question. Whose history is this we've been struggling to articulate? Whose?
Ours.
Ours. Those of us in the room who have African heritage and don't visibly have African heritage, scholars suggest that perhaps the majority of people of African heritage are not seen as African American, but are classified as white American. Those of us who have African heritage or who have native heritage, we have not paid the price that heritage has cost others. Which means that for us, it's a different kind of a challenge to claim our history. But nonetheless, it is our history. Participation of the slave master's children in the reconstruction of America will depend in large part on what James Baldwin called a certain difficult repentance. It will be necessary to own the lies of the past. This requires a process of confession.